So the practice of Dhamma is the transition from the group evolution to individual evolution. Now you have to take responsibility for your own life. If you want to evolve, you have to then do it yourself, because the large segment of society is just going to keep going around in circles like that through birth and death, trapped in the web of their karma. But when you understand the Dhamma, that Dhamma is the spiral path that breaks out of that cyclic conditioning, breaking the pattern of neurons in the brain and creating new pathways to think and act. So to start practicing Dhamma requires a lot of energy. To break that inertia, to break that circle, it takes a lot of energy to kind of break it and start going outside of the circle. And it also takes a lot of courage and a lot of honesty. And as I mentioned before, because a lot of your own family, they won't understand what you're doing, and they'll basically kind of think you're a little loose nuts or totally crazy and not want to have anything to do with you in some extreme cases. And it takes a lot of courage to do that. And that's why not very many people really make that transition and really think for themselves and do what they feel, that inner longing. You know, everyone has the longing to be free. But sometimes that means walking a solitary path. And that people are afraid of that. Because people are basically, they have herd instinct, like a herd of sheep or herd of cows. They feel more comfortably in a big group. When they have to start thinking for themselves, then that's a little bit, insecure. Because so many lifetimes we've been just part of the group. But in order to evolve beyond the human being status, the next step of evolution, at least according to the Dhamma, is instead of being a human being an enlightened being, making that transition, or the next stage of evolution is to an enlightened being. And breaking out of the wheel of birth and death. And that's what the practice of the Dhamma is. And in a sense, that's what these people who are going to be taking 8 lifetime precepts, you might say that could be the first little step where you make a commitment. Taking refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha is actually just taking refuge in the truth, and taking refuge in something that's beyond birth and death. So, it's very useful also to remember the similes, the simile of the mountain of bones in all of our lifetimes and all the suffering that we've encountered, that the pile of bones would reach higher than the Himalayan mountains, and the tears that we've shed in samsara, crying, and the blood we've shed would fill the oceans. And so it's enough to want to say enough is enough in terms of the kind of the suffering and confusion that even people experience in the mind. So, the conscious undertaking of the Dhamma is basically that first step toward the higher evolution, or for the individual evolution. Because the work comes from within yourself. Within the mind, we see how our mind is caught in the web of greed, hatred, and delusion. And we're going to, no one else is going to save you. Each person has to do this precious work. And no one can experience your pain. No one can experience your fear. People can have sympathy, of course, and, you know, things like that, but they can't actually feel what is inside of your own mind and body. And so it's a, you know, it's kind of a solitary path in one sense, but of course we share that, whatever we can share, whatever happiness and insight and understanding we get through the practice, we can, you know, share that with others. So the reflection, you know, the mindfulness of death is the goal to overcome laziness. Even though we have the desire to want to meditate and change, laziness is such a strong, inherent sort of character. It's the inertia. Because we've been just going with the wheel, rolling with the wheel, and it hasn't taken any work, really. Doesn't take any effort to be angry and hateful and greedy and egotistical. These all come naturally for most people because of the conditioning. It's easy to do that, but it's hard to reverse that process. And so it, you know, it needs an initial impetus and motivation. And so the contemplation of death, and especially the repetition about how, you know, you can just, if you can't remember past lives, you can go back and remember last year, 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 15 years ago, and just remember all the countless times you've repeated the same kind of mistakes and habits over again because of just not knowing the truth or following what other people do. Being caught in that grip of greed, hatred, and delusion. And when you really kind of contemplate it like that, it becomes like, you know, wow, like a real eye-opener. And that's when, you know, that people get that motivation to be, to do something about it. Knowing that no one else is going to do it for you. But even though we have the desire to change, again, as I mentioned, it's not that easy. But the Noble Eightfold Path is that, you know, is the path of practice, the way to live, think, and meditate that will gradually allow us to cultivate the skills of and those steps of the Eightfold Path, and especially the skills of meditation. And I think you're all probably familiar with the Eightfold Path, and you can certainly read Bhante Gunaratana's excellent book on the eight mindful steps. But it starts with understanding. You know, the right understanding is the crucial thing. And there's three pillars out of the Eightfold Path. There's three, you know, sort of most important ones. The first is the right understanding. That means kind of knowing the truth. And it begins with intellectual understanding, but that gets you started. And then there's the right mindfulness and right effort. So out of all the eight steps of the Eightfold Path, right understanding, right mindfulness, and right effort are the three most important of those. Because without those, you won't be able to practice right speech, right thought, and action, and the rest of them. So right understanding means knowing what is right and what is wrong in terms of the Dhamma. In terms of what is skillful, what is unskillful. So right understanding understands what is wrong thought, and it understands what is right thought. It understands what is right speech, what is wrong speech. It understands what is right action, what is wrong action. It understands what is wrong livelihood, what is right livelihood. It understands what is right effort, what wrong effort. It understands what is right mindfulness and what is wrong mindfulness. And what is right concentration and wrong concentration. You might say, wrong concentration? How can you have wrong concentration? Well, a cat can concentrate on a mouse, you know, not be distracted at all and be totally intent on that mouse with desire to pounce on it. But that's wrong concentration, because there's no wisdom behind that concentration and no right mindfulness behind that concentration. Anyway, coming back to the... So right understanding is all important. Without that, nothing else can be done. Then mindfully, when you observe a unwholesome thought arising in the mind, you're mindful of it. Ah, unwholesome thought is arising. Or this thought is arising, the understanding recognizes it as a wrong thought. Let's say the thought of ill will. And then the effort to drive that wrong thought out of the mind and the effort to substitute it with the right thought, such as substituting ill will with metta, or substituting telling that lie with telling the truth, or substitute stealing that thing for giving something. So in that way, that's how those three pillars of the Eightfold Path are important. Now, I wanted to talk a bit about some actual, very practical, you know, one of the most powerful aids to developing, you know, our mind practice of mindfulness in the daily life. Now, when people come to retreats and they hear the Dhamma and they practice Dhamma, and you know, you kind of rekindle your enthusiasm for practice. It's like a battery charge. And during the retreat, you say, "Yes, and now I'm going to really every day. I'm going to try to meditate once or twice a day. Let's say ideally twice a day." Because when you come on a retreat, it's really easy to, because of your self-consciousness, you come to the sessions on time, and you, even though it's painful, you sit through the whole hour, and you overcome your sleepiness and so on. But when you go home and you don't have the group situation or the teacher sort of watching you, then that old laziness comes back. So even though you have good intentions, you're going to go home and you're going to say, "I'm going to sit for two times a day, morning and evening." And the first day or two, maybe you will. But then gradually the busyness of your daily life starts to pick up speed again, and you're too tired at night, so usually the evening meditation goes off. Or for others who are not morning people, the morning meditation goes off. And you're only sitting once a day. And then a few more days later, a week later, you know, 1 hour of meditation goes to 45 minutes. A few days later, it goes down to 30 minutes. A few days later, it goes down to 15 minutes. And then before you know it, as you're going out the door, taking your last drink of coffee, you pat the Buddha on the head, "Namo Buddha." And that's all your meditation. You know, "Meditate for me, Buddha, please." So many people find themselves in that dilemma. And that's, of course, why people come to retreats. Because for many people, when they come on a retreat is the only time when they really get an extended period of quality time to contemplate. And then when you do that, you can tell that you're able to at least make a little progress on dealing with your pain, on being more mindful, and perhaps getting some deeper insights. But it's difficult for people to to keep the practice up in daily life. So we've come up with a supplemental type of practice, or a practice for people who are always saying, I don't have time to meditate, I'm too tired to meditate, because they think meditation means sitting for a whole half an hour or 45 minutes or an hour. It's very difficult for the mind to find a whole chunk of time, even just a half an hour, you know, because time's so precious, where our mind gets so easily distracted. So there's a practice called the M&Ms. I know many of you have heard this before, especially who've come to my retreats, and Bhanteji talks about it too. It's a special practice called M&M. It stands for Minute Meditation. And you know the M&M candies, right? They're small and sweet. Well, this is small and sweet. It's the Buddhist M&M. And what's the motto of M&Ms?
Not seen, not in your mouth, not in
your hand. Yeah. Well, the Buddhist M&M, the meditation M&M, melts in your mind, not in your hand. Anyway, that's a practice, a specific training where you train yourself to stop once an hour for 1 minute. And you kind of just, you know, stop whatever one was doing, whatever busyness one was doing. Just stop, kind of freeze in your tracks. Even when you're best done, even actually when you're standing, or it can be done in any posture. But just stop whatever one was doing. Let go of the past and future. Let go of that neurotic push into the future and just come to the body. And just feel the body in whatever position it's in. Whether it's standing, sitting, walking, laying down. Of course, if you're walking, you kind of just stop and stand. And just, feel it. And take a couple of deep, slow breaths. And just come back to breathing in, standing, breathing out, standing. And just basically practice being. Alternatively, I call it the practice of being instead of doing. Because people are constantly doing the whole day long. And if they're not physically doing, they're mentally doing. Their mind is occupied in various thoughts or worries, preoccupations, and fantasies, or brooding over the past, or scheming up the revenge or something. So you kind of let all that go and you just come to the body. And just feel, you know, try to feel any sensations, but especially the contact points, like the feet. And just park your mind in neutral gear. Like when you come and you park your car, you put it in neutral, or not even park. Let's say you come to a red light, which you don't normally put your engine in neutral, but let's say you put it in neutral. And the engine's still going. The engine symbolizes awareness. And when you rev the engine up, it goes, vroom, vroom. That might be the thoughts. But the car doesn't move. It means, you know, we can't speak or act. You'll create karma. Even though there might be thoughts in the mind, the thoughts, the engine's not, the car is not going to move. When we park the mind in neutral and just even observing your thoughts, it means awareness. So it means just practicing 1 minute of awareness. And then you continue on what you were doing. But you train yourself to stop every hour for, you know, just 1 minute. And the reason why we pick 1 minute is because it's kind of psychological. Anybody can really stop for 1 minute. Anybody can kind of pause for 1 minute. But if I ask you, come on, let's stop, let's sit down and meditate for 20 minutes. 20 minutes, blah, 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 I have to pick a moment. Impossible. But if I say, I'm going to stop for 1 minute. 1 minute. 1 minute? Well, yeah. You have to. You feel kind of foolish saying you can't stop for 1 minute. 20 minutes, okay, you can see that, right? But 1 minute, because we waste so much time during the day, frittering away our time, you know, looking around and criticizing this person's clothing and that person's, so on and so on. We're just letting our minds spin out into the past and future. But you can ground it to the body. That's what's so wonderful about the mindfulness of the body. We carry this thing around with us 24/7, 365. The last number we don't know. But you know, we carry this bag of bones around with us. You know, 100 pounds, 120 pounds, 160 pounds. Why don't we use it? Use it for something useful. Rather than using it for to cultivate vanity, or use it for dominating others, or use it creating pain in it by doing unskillful things and causing unnecessary pains. You use this body for a good purpose, for practicing mindfulness. Because it's free, it's there. And it's the natural thing. All you have to do is simply pause and boom, oh yes. Feel the blood pulsing in your veins. Feel the heart beating. Feel the breath going in and out. Feel the clothes touching your skin. Feel the little prickling sensations. It's actually quite beautiful and wonderful to do that. But it's so relaxing. Because you get the mind off the freeway of the past and future. Of that, the freeway of just scatterbrained thinking or worry and agitation. And just, you know, come home to the body. And but during that minute, you can also reflect, what was this mind doing in that last hour? What were you chewing over? What were you worrying about? Or did you get angry in the last hour? And if you did, practice forgiveness there and then, before allowing that anger or anything else to start lodging into your mind, cut it off at its root by, in that minute meditation, you can practice forgiveness. That person that just insulted you, that person that just, you know, did something. You say, okay, I know you did that because, you know, you have sickness just like everybody else. It's not your real self, you know. And forgive them just as you would like other people to forgive you. We also have to forgive others. And just as you know, you yourself make mistakes, slip up, so do others. So, but that's an excellent time to forgive anybody who crossed you in the last hour, and then send them metta. Or you can just, for 1 minute, just metta. May all beings be well and happy. May all beings be free from suffering. And that will create a lightness in the mind, and then you continue on. But if you do that, if you can do that every hour during the day, by the end of the day, you have at least 10 or 12 quality minutes of meditation. Whereas if you sit for one period of meditation, a long meditation a day, let's say you do sit for 30 minutes. Most people, if they're honest, out of a 30-minute meditation, they'd be lucky if they had 5 or 10 minutes that they could actually say they were meditating, or that they were truly concentrated and had bright awareness. Especially people who are, you know, caught, you know, in the busy world, because you know, part of that time you'd be in and out of drowsiness, or thinking about what you have to do that day, or so many other things. And also the repetition, which is what's important. You meditate for 30 minutes once a day, okay, that is good. But then you have 23 and a half hours gap when you're probably not very concentrated or mindful. And so whatever benefit you might have gotten through a 30-minute meditation, it quickly gets dissipated. by such a long gap before you meditate again. And there's a subtle kind of thing that comes into the mind. We say, oh, I meditated for 30 minutes today. I did my hour of meditation. I'm a good little Buddhist. Bhante would be proud of me. And then you kind of like pat yourself on the back, right? Then you get up and then you, oh, now I can do some mischief. or let your mind run a little bit. Like a reward, right, for doing your meditation. I mean, this happens, of course, kind of unconsciously. So by frequently repeating the meditation, even though it's short, the repetition can have a more lasting and powerful effect than just meditating once in a while when you feel like it. A lot of people say, I meditate when I feel like it. But most of the time they don't feel like it. That's a problem. Now the best time to practice those minutes of meditation, actually the very best time of all is the moment you wake up in the morning. If you can train yourself, when you hear that alarm clock go off or whenever you just naturally feel the mind coming out, if you can at that moment be aware of waking, and kind of just observe the process of the mind waking up out of sleep, and then immediately just feel the body laying. So, okay, now I'm waking up. Okay, don't rush. And just kind of, slowly and kind of move a bit, so straighten up. Maybe just even while you're laying there, take a deep, slow breath. Okay, today's a new day, don't rush. And you just slowly kind of sit up from the bed. And then you stand up. And even if you have a full bladder and you feel like rushing to the bathroom, don't immediately run. Just, most people can hold it a few more seconds, right? So you can, just be aware of those sensations. Or wear a bag. But anyway, you stand up, take a deep, slow breath, and just be aware of that tendency to want to rush, just slow down. The world's going to wait. And then practice an M&M. Maybe just, do a few rounds of may all beings be well and happy, may all beings be free from suffering. And then you go to the bathroom. Then you can speed up, go to the bathroom. But if you can start like that, that kind of gets an edge into the consciousness, and it will help you to be more mindful the rest of the day. If you immediately just get up and start panicking, or maybe get up late, right, and you're panicking, oh, I got up late, and that's when people start rushing and lose their mindfulness and trip over something and fall down because they're not really mindful. They wind up making mistakes and having to repeat, stop and clean up their mess or repeat something over again. And then when you're having breakfast, after you put your oatmeal on the stove to heat up or put the toast in the oven, instead of immediately doing something else, just pause. Take a deep breath. Do an M&M then. This is going to take a couple minutes for the oatmeal to cook or the water to boil. And then going on, when you finished eating, when you stand up from the chair before immediately rushing to do the dishes, just stand up, your hands on the chair, kind of stand up straight, take a deep breath, just breathing in, standing, breathing out, standing, may all beings be well and happy, may all beings be free from suffering. And then slowly start going. I mean, it doesn't really take a lot of time. But it'll be very, very valuable because you'll notice that refreshing, just to break that rush. As I mentioned before, most people have there's a hand behind them constantly pushing, even when they don't have to, because it's been such a habit that we cultivate. And to just pause and break that, it's so refreshing. That's why I say it melts in your mind, not in your hand. because that pause of breaking that neurotic push into the future, letting go of the past and future, and just feeling the life force bubbling in your veins, you know. That's why the more you can feel the body, the more pleasant it is. And the quicker you can get your attention to just come to the body, the easier it will do. That's why I've been trying to teach you that during this retreat. You know, to pause. Instead of when I say stand up, just don't immediately stand up. Slowly stretch the legs out, come to the squatting position, pause. So you come to being. It doesn't even have to be for 1 minute, it can be just for 5 seconds even. But you get that little pause in there. And in that one pause, or in that 1 minute, you know, the whole Dhamma can crystallize there in your mind. You know, all the wisdom of the Dhamma can actually just come into the mind in that 1 minute. And it's like you did a whole hours of meditation in one minute. Because that's the power of the Dhamma and the power of mindfulness. You know, the moment you just stop and pause and come to the present moment, boom, all the wisdom of the Buddha is right in front of your eyes. If you know how to see it, of course, you have to train yourself. And that's the importance of right understanding. The more understanding you have, and the more you repeat it by cultivating right thought and so on, the more it becomes instant knowledge to draw on. It's like having plugged into the internet, the Dhamma internet, Dhamma net. Right now you have to fumble around Google, S-A-T-I-P, you know, Satipatthana, what was that sutta? You know, by that time Mara has already dominated our mind. But when you fill your mind with Dhamma, by, you know, learning and practicing, then it becomes instant recall. And almost at any moment, you have this whole internet of Dhamma knowledge and the things that you've read and remembered can come into the mind that you can apply to almost any aspect of one's life or anything that's occurring in your, you know, your body and mind. So that's why, you know, I mean, because you know, from my own experience, I found a great benefit from doing that those 1 minute meditation, because it's doable. And you know, it doesn't. All it takes is remembering to do it. And another best time to do that is before you have to go talk to somebody where there might be some tension, like before you have to go and talk to your children about their messy room or the seedy characters they're hanging out with, or the bag of marijuana you found under their bed. Yeah. I got that one from personal experience. My mother, or you have to talk to your husband about the taxes, or how to raise the children, or you have to talk to your boss about the raise, or the colleague that's telling lies about you in order to take your job, or any number of things. So whenever you know that you have to go to talk to somebody where there might be some tension from your knowledge of your past experiences, you prep yourself. And you just, before going into that room or whatever, you know, just stand, take a couple of deep breaths, just ground yourself and just remind yourself, okay, whatever happens in there, let me not lose my cool, let me maintain my mindfulness. And hopefully that will then help you when you're in that conversation and you feel this, the other person starting to say some stuff that you disagree with, you can feel the tension arising, you can, you know, feel that, okay, relax. You know. Don't blurt out something, you know, let the person, let his steam off or her steam off, and carefully listen to what they're saying so you don't misinterpret what they're trying to say, and you have time to carefully consider a response that's not going to, like, compound complicate the situation more than it is, or just simply keep quiet. Because if you know you're in conversation with people, you know, speech it causes more suffering sometimes than a punch in your nose, or even a bullet wound. You know, bullet wounds will heal, you know, pretty fast, or at least a lot of them. But, you know, ill words between people, you know, like wounds that can last for a long time. And people don't forget it. Even just one slip up, you know, can really, you know, it's amazing how people's minds will grab on to just a certain word or even a body language and, you know, and take that and start working on it. And even if it's even if it's not true, or, you know, the mind misjudges what, you know, people say. The ego is always out to protect itself and gets what it wants. So it twists what people say to conform to its own opinions and ego, even though it wasn't the intention of the person who was actually saying that. You know, it's very complicated, you know, the mind. So anyway, practicing these M&Ms like that, and let alone once an hour or 1 minute, even when you have a spare 5 seconds here, spare 10 seconds there, spare 15 seconds there, you know, you can just pause even for the amount of just one breath. Like you come to a red light in your car and you know you got at least 10, 15 seconds before it's going to turn. Instead of looking around, oh, a new Mercedes, I wish I had one of those. Or, you know, look at that ugly guy over there. You know, just keep your eyes on yourself. Feel the steering wheel. Just be aware of, you know, sitting, sitting, sitting. Take a couple deep breaths until you hear the guy behind honking, "Hey, buddy!" Oh. Okay. So you don't have to close your eyes. You can keep the eyes open. But the main thing is to train our mind, not let our mind just, you know, the second you pause, the mind is keyed into just rushing in a million directions because that's its habit. So you have to train yourself to watch that. And because the body is something we always have with us and it's always really in your face, you don't have to look, where's my body, where's my body? No, no, it's your buttocks are pressing the cushion. You know, that earth element, it's very in your face if you just boom, and it's enough to hold your attention there without allowing it to go. Or you're standing in the shop out checkout line at the supermarket. It's a very common one, right? And you have your cart full of groceries and you're going to the 10 items or less counter, right? Obeying the laws, and then some person over here comes with a big cart and, you know, cuts in front, and, you know, you can see this anger arising. Instead of shouting, "Hey, lady, go to the back of the line," you know, you can have compassion. "Well, this lady probably has 5 kids. You know, she's in a hurry. Come on, go ahead. Practice patience. You have a chance to practice patience and loving kindness." Or you can see your own self-righteousness. "Oh, I'm obeying the laws. These people are breaking the law." You know, the ego always wanted to assert itself. So, you know, you can, by keeping coming back to touch base with the body, and it can help to observe those things and not get carried away with these sort of thoughts that, you know, would disturb your centeredness. Where you're standing there waiting and said, "Oh, Michael Jackson was reborn in Georgia." Oh. You know, People's Magazine or what. So, you know, you're waiting, just keep the mind in the body. May all beings be, you know, all these shoppers running around, women yelling at their kids or something, and may all beings be well and happy. May all beings be free from suffering. Not allowing your mind to get caught up in judgments, comparisons, criticisms, looking around. Because that's the mind's normal habit. And it does that simply because we never trained it. Our mind is just like a wild dog that'll run around anywhere it wants. barking, getting into trash cans, you know, molesting other dogs. So our mind, in a sense, is, you know, does that too. So this is a training. You know, it's really about training the mind. The Dhamma is really nothing about but training the mind. Of course, it's training the body too, but the body only is under the influence of the mind. When the mind is trained, the body will be trained. But it's not easy to train the mind. That's why with the practice of sila, sila is a way to at least to stop the body. You know, when the body's stopped, then you can observe the mind that's still going on, and then hopefully slow the mind down. And, you know, that's really practicing the Dhamma, you know, in the daily life. And also, anytime you, there's so many reminders of the Dhamma, and especially about the old age and death. Every time you see an old person or somebody that's sick, or you hear about death, you know, the Buddha's instructions are say, ah, I too am subject to that. My mind and body has not gone beyond that state yet. And instead of saying, oh, that's a shame, poor little baby, you know, poor little doggy. No, you reflect on it. Ah, I also am subject to getting hit by a car, coming down with any kind of diseases. Or any time you find your mind, judging others and comparing or even making fun of people and so on, and telling jokes about on other people's expense, that's considered not, you know, a kind of unwholesome types of thoughts and speech as well. So anyway, we can use the things of the daily life to remind us of impermanence and death. And every night, as part of your evening meditation, just ask you, what have I done today to prepare myself? You know, what little bit have I done to let go at least a tiny bit of anger? What have I done to promote a tiny bit of kindness, of generosity, of patience? You know, which of those four horses are you? You remember the simile of the four horses? Anybody remember that? You're all sleeping? You know, which of the four thoroughbred horses? Are you going to wait until you get poked in the ribs with an iron bar before you realize, oh, I might actually get, I might die. And then start practicing. So those, you know, the meditation on death is one of the, what is called the one of the protections, along with metta. They protect our mind from laziness, and metta protects the mind from ill will and resentment and egocentricness by opening up, you know, to others. And that, so really the reflection on death is a goad to overcome the laziness. When you see yourself lazy, not wanting to get up, you know, so early to meditate, and realize that, you know, you might die by the afternoon. And what progress could you have made in that extra half an hour? And, you know, this is really using the Dhamma in the daily life. And these things don't take a lot of time. It doesn't require hours and hours of meditation. But it does require some, of course, those longer meditations are certainly valuable and necessary too. But on a regular basis, these M&Ms will provide the interim gap, to close the the gap between other meditations and make mindfulness more continuous. As I mentioned before, the more frequently you come to the present moment, just reflect on the Dhamma, even if it's just for a minute. But the more you do it, it will close those gaps, and then you'll find that coming into your mind, even when you're not trying to do it, that mindfulness will come into the mind almost effortlessly, start coming in effortlessly. And that's when it kind of really starts taking off. Because it's out there in daily life, that's where you're committing the karma. You know, while you're meditating, of course you're committing good karma meditating, but it's out there in the daily life when you're encountering negativity, when you're encountering all kinds of situations, that's when you need your mindfulness. Not to lose your cool, not to overreact, and so on, in creating negative karma that then we're going to have guilt, worry, remorse, or fear about. You know, it's out there in the daily life. And again, the four anys. Anything can happen to any person at any time in any place. So will we be ready to have the appropriate measured response to any situation which will not create more sticky type of karma? Repeat the habits. So that's why those M&Ms are really very valuable, and that's why I wanted to share with you this last part of the retreat of how you can integrate the practice in daily life, because that's the biggest question. Every single retreat, that's the biggest question people have. How can I practice in the midst of busy daily life? Because, you know, people have to work hard, do a lot of things, so at night they're too tired. See, I can understand that, sure. You know, they may not feel like meditating at night. But if you have the chance only to meditate at one time in the day, morning is actually the best time. And even if you're not a morning person, you can change it. You know, you can change the mind and its habits if you put energy to it. But the morning meditation will set up the vibration in the body, mind, to help you during the daytime when it's going to be the most necessary, needed, or useful. And in the evening, you can practice a shorter one, especially like forgiveness. So in the evening, just think back during the day, anybody you had some negative feeling to, you know, rather than letting that kind of sit in there and fester or something, you know, just practice forgiveness, or like we were doing last night, you know, just bring that up and say, okay, forgive you. Or forgive yourself. If you were unmindful and you were being angry at yourself, forgive yourself also. Or ask people for forgiveness if you know you did something to them. So this is really how we practice the Dhamma in daily life. It's those small things. A lot of people think, oh, they're waiting for the big bang to happen, right? The explosion of light in their mind, or stream entry, or jhana, or whatever they might imagine. Now, those things, may or may not happen. Those aren't the really important ones. I mean, they are important, but in terms of daily life and the karma and maintaining a state of relaxation and inner equanimity and so on, it's the daily practice of mindfulness and pausing that's going to set the groundwork that when you do meditate longer, you'll be able to get more easily into meditation. The reason why it takes you so long to calm your mind is because, you just come off the street and then come in and sit down and, think you're just going to try to concentrate. And you have all this agitation of the whole day long, memories of things that are, going to make it not easy. But if during the day you can maintain these moments of pausing, minutes of reflection during the day, and not allowing ill will to build up in your mind or stress. You release the stress every hour by practicing an M&M. You release the stress every hour instead of building it up. And so by the end of the day, hopefully you'd feel more rested and peaceful and to do a longer meditation. So I think I'm gonna sort of stop with this, and I hope that you all were able to learn, you know, something during this retreat. And I hope that the main thing is to, you know, to, you know, try to make it practical enough that, you know, that you can, you know, try to apply these things to make them practical, because what people need, they need the practical things to apply, not just lofty theories and so on, but something that they can easily draw on to use in a skillful way in their daily life to minimize unnecessary tears and anxiety and suffering. And does anybody have any final question they'd like to ask? Yes? Yes.
The yoga in the morning seems to wake me up. At home, I get up and meditate first thing. Somebody just spoke to that. I don't know how it went wrong.
In my opinion, it's best to do at least a few exercises, because that'll help you wake up and hopefully to be more alert during that meditation. So that's why I always encourage to do the yoga before the meditate, because that's the purpose of it, to be able to have you more in touch with the sensations and to be more awake. But, you know, sometimes you might do it the other way around. You may feel like just meditating first, and if you can sit and still be awake and alert, then that's also fine. It, you know, just depends. Each person has to kind of use these things to suit their need, because people are different. So, yes.
You had mentioned when we are dying or about to die to do metta, or to let go into the flow of impermanence. A couple of months ago, I was on a plane that I thought was going to go down, and it was so scary. And the only thing I could remember to do in that time was to take refuge. Is that something that you would recommend if we find that we're in a situation where we're about to die? If our minds can't remember to go to metta or whatever, but my mind always remembers to take refuge, because I do that.
I think before getting on the flight, take refuge. And, you know, when the plane is going down, that's the time to practice. It's not me, not me, not mine, not myself. And just experience floating, 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 floating.
But the mind goes into fear. I mean, that's for me, that's a higher level when I've reached a higher level. I need something more accessible.
Whatever works for you.
Okay.
You know, all these different things, as I mentioned just before that, each person will find that they work in different ways and at different times. And so that's the main thing. The Dhamma is like, it's a medicine to help cure us. And so if the taking the refuge like that helps you to, in the last minute, to calm down, then that's okay. Yeah. But oftentimes, you know, it's you know, if we've already, you know, we take refuge. Your whole practice should be the refuge, actually. You know, you're taking refuge in the Dhamma. In practicing the Dhamma itself, we're already taking the refuge. But it's the ability to have the mind open and not grasp onto that fear or other things that is going to be a critical factor. But it's true. There's stories in the Buddhist text about somebody at the time of death, they just remembered the Buddha and it helped them, you know, to attain the stage of once returning or something. So, you know, these things are very powerful. Okay, I think we're kind of out of time because we want to prepare for the ceremony. So, anyway, I wish you all the best in your life. And, as you know, by the after lunch sometime, I'll try to write my blog address down. I have a blog where people like to keep track of my schedule, where I'm going to be teaching here and there. Also, my books are available for download on the blog, as well as links to websites of some YouTube lectures I've been giving on YouTube, or Dhamma talks. In fact, the Dhamma talks from this retreat, at some point, we're going to have put them up on some website. I don't know sure when yet, which one, but either the MediaFire public access website, or perhaps the Ottawa Buddhist Society website, or something. But that information would be on my blog, and I'll try to write that blog address. But if everything fails, just Google in Bhante Rahula, and you'll probably, with a little maneuvering, come to the website. Not the website, the blog. You know. Yeah, hopefully I'll try to do that. Yeah, on that, I'll try to pin it up on that board or that.
Bhante, put it, does it come up when you Google Bhante Rahula?
I think it does. Yeah. You just have to spell Bhante Rahula properly.
See, can I just have your attention? The eight lifetime precepts. Just for